So it occurred to me before dialing in here how absurd it is to have you on the phone and talk about what other people talk about. It seems almost absurd.
Yeah.
And it's so much the mind's version of, oh, no, not lists. We want to look over there. And yet, I still want to do it because I was listening to some recordings while I was in the gym, but mm-hmm. I get why it's sort of the unspoken rule with Peter is that you don't really, you know, ask him questions about other teachers' teachings.
Oh. He might reply to it. I don't know. I like to talk about other stuff. What's really other?
Yeah.
Oh, this is just a kind of a soup of a soup of togetherness, right? So, gossip at will. I think that was the fifth noble truth. Really. After you finish with the Eightfold Path and you realize there was nothing there for you, then the fifth noble truth, which few people get to, you know, because it's hidden behind the Eightfold Path, but the fifth noble truth is, now that you realize what a waste of time this has been, please gossip at will.
At least have fun with it, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
That version of what a waste of time this has been has been described as just like the cosmic laugh. You know, you see through what you think was this big giant thing and you gotta just laugh.
Laugh.
By what a waste of time this has been, do you mean our whole lives?
Our whole sneaker fucker lives.
I can throw in the rest.
Let me speak for myself. My whole sneaker fucker lives.
Yeah, that's been a tragedy in the making.
It's starting to get, like, actually pretty comical. It's like, what was I doing and what the hell am I going to do now? Does it really, and does it even matter?
Yeah. Well, you know, this stuff is as frivolous as we might make it. You know, it's not, this stuff's not kidding around. It can kind of reframe the arbitrary prioritization that we have subscribed to. It's that deviant.
What do you mean by arbitrary prioritization? Meaning what we claim is important in this?
Yeah, what you take your life to be and what you take time to be, what you take ego to be, what you take spiritual and intimate gratification to be, what we might long for, what we might imagine we're missing, what we regret.
Well, it's,
I mean, that's all of that is a, you know, all of that is a signature of loyalty. And so if this has the potential that it has as a call it a deviant way of receiving your present experience, then it can really seriously obliterate the entirety of your familiar loyalty structure all the way down. And that's what you could say most seeker fuckers think they're interested in, but still resist, mostly on or subconsciously, because they still want to succeed, you know, as a joy conjuring machine, as a seeker fucker. They, or we, most of us, aren't really ready to tackle with deviant failure. There's no There's no support for it in the popular culture. Shit, there's no support for it in the corner yoga studio culture. Dare I say there's little support for it at the retreat center. That's how deviant this is. You can have all kinds of teachers, teachings, and accoutrements on sale at the gift shop, but no one is really prepared or interested in taking this on.
That word failure seems to really have been the touchstone of having met you, and I'm not putting it on
sorry.
It seems to have abated a little bit, but the last year and a half, I have never felt more of a failure in my life.
Wow.
Like failure at every turn, failure in how I treat other people, failure in holy shit, what I've invested in and thought was really the cat's meow is just bullshit.
Yep.
And yet I seem to be still doing it. Failure in being the kind of person I thought I was or was supposed to at least strive for.
Absolutely.
It's like everywhere I looked, that was it. It seems to have abated a little bit, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it's kind of up to you. You could call that a good year and a half or a not so good year and a half.
I'm glad it's a little better.
I mean, look how tenuous and tenacious our loyalty is.
Totally tenuous.
And totally tenacious.
My job's going pretty well and I'm, you know, feeling pretty good, and that could get all swept away in a heartbeat.
You know, the remarks from breakfast last Sunday about encountering, let's call it a hypnagogic substance from nature, and having one's entire consciousness just completely swept off the table, like a Buddhist monk might blow away a sand painting. That's why it's really a very curious adventure
to do that, is what you mean, or just this whole process?
Yes, the process of, call it, subtle iterations of self-reflection that depart from the human.
Well, I think this method, in a way, people don't take to it because it's kind of gradual, whereas the drug thing is not. But I don't see how the drug thing could ever stay with you. But this is like one tiny revelation after another that finally yields a, oh my God, this is insane. But
yes,
you can rest in that insanity finally. It doesn't matter what you've done, what you're going to do, what you are doing.
Yeah, it's a very curious relationship with, you know, the irrefutable fact of being, but no longer filtering through the imagination of time, space, and call it human loyalty memes. Mm-hmm. But and that's why you can see, as you get a taste of it and play with it and, you know, let it kick you around, which it loves to do, how the corner yoga studio, there's no interest.
I mean,
on the meditation retreat, there's little interest. And the authorities, whether they're Western Buddhists masquerading as Vipassana, you know, experts, or Asians masquerading as something else, they may attempt to celebrate or encourage these practices, but the fruition of these practices, revealing themselves to be transhuman, is not really on their agenda. So you are, in a sense, forced to keep moving, you know, like a rolling stone gathers no moss. because most of the places we might turn in the popular culture, or even in the popular contemplative culture, are false. All of Vipassana is false. The Four Noble Truths are false. The Eightfold Path is false. The Gnostic Christian or the Gnostic Judaic is false. The Kabbalah is false. Because what this is cannot be represented through systems or through the hand or mind of, call it, humankind. That's how wonderfully but maddeningly self-obliterating your present experience actually is. And that if we try to cling to a system or a frame of reference or a devotion of some kind, then we're selling ourselves short, digging our nails deeply into a granite cliff from which we are sliding at 32 feet per second per second.
I guess becoming comfortable with the certainty that that is the truth all the time is the hardest
yes,
part.
Of course. I mean, it's the easiest and the hardest. Mm-hmm. It's the easiest because the revelation operates with total impunity. It's the hardest when we try to, let's say, hold it as an ideation. That's why, you know, this transmutative process encourages us, invites us, nudges us to shift from representation to first-hand revelation. And first-hand revelation, as it sneaks up on you, you can see how little it has to do with your will, your agreement. First-hand revelation is obliterating and thus, you know, maddeningly joyful. Everything else, you know, is the aftermath of ideation. And we're not happy living as the byproduct or consequence of ideation. We don't like it.
Meaning as a person that's vulnerable and desperate and fucked up.
Those, and even all that, you know, the person that's vulnerable, ... is a gross overlay on top of subtle loyalties that you have in the nature of present being. I mean, this is a shock. It's an absolute shock. It's absolutely antithetical to the mirage of belief, to the mirage of explanation, to the mirage of comparison, of building blocks, of outcome or consequence.
Well, it seems like it's a shock every time you take a step into the more. So you know, you find something that you feel is it has a subtlety, you can appreciate it, and then pretty soon you find that it's just another level of subtlety, you know, that there's still every element that there is in everything else that you run into in life.
So yeah, it's curious. There's no real satisfaction to be found in what it is that's discovered, no matter how subtle it may be. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we've seen a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sunrise, or it's possible that things can be beautiful even midday.
And, really? I don't know.
I've never seen it, but I've heard told. And you'll notice how frustrating it is that when we are confronted by incredible beauty or depthful emotion, that there's just no way we can cling to it. We cannot package it.
Yeah.
We can't take it home. We can't experience it at will. We are, right, grains of sand falling through our own hands from moment to moment. And because we are, you could say, conditioned to be graspers and knowers, accumulators, and packagers.
Sorry.
That's quite all right. My dear is in the midst of a coughing jag.
And my sympathies.
Thank you. So in the midst of this, which is simply disappearing in front of our own nose, we can't help but suffer a schizophrenic frustration because we've been taught to be skilled and successful accumulators. And we cannot grasp or accumulate our own nature. And this kind of madness we manage to habituate to or sweep under the rug. And so we start blaming everything and everyone else for an existential frustration that we cannot articulate. I mean, it's so potent that it might drive us to drink at a minimum. And so we'll spend, you know, the better part of our lives trying to remedy an existential frustration which no one ever spoke to us about. We are surrounded by, you know, creatures and volumes of information, psychiatric and otherwise, and no one, you know, is able to articulate, hey, look, I'm really sorry. This just is melting off your face from moment to moment, and we're going to have to come up with some other way of measuring joy, measuring dignity, measuring bliss than the ways that we have, because the ways that we have failed us. And this is as much true on the meditation cushion as it is, you know, at the crack house.
Well, I've been noticing the, you know, talk about, and you've mentioned in your posts about the commoditization, I guess, of non-duality or Advaita, what have you. It's like anything can be commoditized. I mean, anything
yes.
that has any substance will be commoditized, and yes. that included. And it's just remarkable to me. I mean, there's some real glitzy stuff out there. I don't mean to go off in that direction, but it's just something I've noticed lately that there are people that actually, I kind of like their message in a way, but it is just so over the top. I mean, it's just resources and websites that are deep that it's like a Billy Graham crusade or something, you know, it's just incredible. And I find that difficult to adjust to. Because, you know, I would much prefer the simpler way. You know?
Well, all of these enlightened fuckers, you know, have to come up with some content in order for you to become a subscriber.
Yeah.
I mean, how do I take your money if I look you square in the face and say, good luck?
Good luck, there's not a damn thing you can do to get there.
Absolutely. Good luck. You are already that which you imagine you're seeking. And the resolution is a radical transmutation in this present consciousness. And I can't gift wrap that.
You know, Jeff, you don't sell it, but you put a lot of your energy and time and focus on talking to us about it. I mean, you invest in it very clearly.
Well, if you weren't here, I'd probably be wandering through the woods talking to the trees about it. And have.
And do. It seems to me, for us, you've been the something that can be done about it.
Yeah.
You need guidance, because I would think as people age, this message is actually quite good. Because you can't hold into society's cultural norms and you've got to achieve things and look great and all this. As you're aging, then you start seeing it's all a joke. So most of our old people just go down to despair.
Yes. The commercial consciousness is doomed to despair.
With the baby boomers moving through our society and moving into that phase that Catherine describes, I would think that the thrust toward looking for something remedial is like this huge wave coming through.
Well, I think that's where the concept of bucket list comes from. They've decided that, I have to have made my life mean something. They realize, they don't realize that is not possible. And can only lead to despair.
Well, you know what, though? I mean, there is some traction, some youthful traction. I've just found over Christmas when my son was up here and his girlfriend. And I made a bunch of copies beforehand of a lot of the posts. And I added the pictures, did it from work where there's a color printer, of course, so they could actually look at something. They're inclined to do it when you thrust it in their lap. She was kind of blown away. She just really liked the message.
Who is this?
This is my son's girlfriend. They're not typical kids, though. I mean, they're mid-20s. But it's unusual. I mean, but there are those out there,
Oh, yeah. I think, actually, those ages are when the mind is the most open.
Yeah. And they're, artists.
Downhill
too.
After that.
They're artists, and she's very much she's a cartoonist, actually. And, I haven't talked to her after, are you still there?
Yes, we're still listening to you.
Oh, sorry. I didn't.
Francine, though.
I didn't touch it. I should have kept something going on the screen there.
But anyway, you're a lot like a cartoonist yourself.
Yeah. I'm a living cartoons.
You look a little like Pokey.
I don't know who Pokey is, but I like the name.
Gumby's equine companion.
Oh, jeez. Just so it's not Eeyore.
Well. Well, I hope that your son's girlfriend join us at some point.
I hope so too.
Thanks for giving them a pamphlet.
In fact, I did that twice. I did that there, and I did it just this week. I had lunch with my friend and another. It's an acquaintance. I just kind of barely know him. He's a marionettist, actually a world famous marionettist.
And God is good at that too.
But he likes Rupert Shiloh. Have you heard of the guy?
Spiro.
Is that it?
Rupert Shiloh, I think, is in the agricultural business.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I don't know.
Teasing.
This is Rupert.
Rupert, there's a Rupert Spira.
Spira, that's it. Yeah.
Rupert Spira.
So I checked out that website, and ooh, boy. That's a It's a lot of stuff there.
Well, you know, Rupert is, he approaches this kind of as an educational academician.
Yes,
he believes that he can convince you into beatitude through the logical observation of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how well it works, but, you know, he's popular, I guess.
Yeah, I see it as a pathway, you know, and I'd rather not be bothered with a particular pathway, you know.
I'm not interested in, yeah, that's right.
But,
it's like,
but he may come to a meeting. He seemed very interested in what I showed him there. And so he may come. He's not far away.
Who, Rupert's coming?
No, Joe, the guy.
Joe Shiloh.
Joe,
the marionettist.
The marionettist. Joe the marionettist is Cash. It's Cashew or something, like some kind of nut.
Oh, Joe Cashew.
Who's the nut?
I'm saying it wrong.
Good one.
Oh, it's Cash. It's Cashmore, I think, or something.
Like the sweater.
Not cashmere.
More than cashmere. Warmer.
Oh my God. Well, Jamie, I can't thank you enough for, you know, the sincere effort you make to share whatever this is or isn't with others. And, of course, it would always be an absolute delight to make their acquaintance.
Yeah, yeah. I was showing it to this guy that I was having lunch with. I get together with him about every 5 or 6 weeks for lunch. And he does the Course of Miracles. I mean, he's not doing it now, but he was leading those for years. But he's a pretty open-minded guy, and I finally got it together to do this thing up, and so I gave it to both of them.
Mm-hmm.
They split in half and half.
Well, you've inspired me. Maybe I'll go through the Facebook page since its inception, and you know, it's easy to turn it into a PDF.
Oh, nice. That's a great idea.
You know, instead of, like, publishing something, just put it on the goddamn website as a downloadable PDF with a, you know, a minimal amount of formatting.
Oh, well, that's...
Amy could share with us what he did, too.
Yeah, but it's in... I certainly, it's in a Word document. But that's only about a dozen of them, you know.
Mm. Well, we'll see how that goes.
Mm-hmm. And I can certainly send that around, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's absolutely delightful in my experience to participate in, you know, small groups and kick this around.
Yeah.
It's fun, you know, and I have fun, you know, even if someone else is at the front of the room doing it and I can get kick back and giggle at them.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something of the rebel, I guess, when you're sitting in a class, essentially a class, you know, or one of these big things where they have a whole program set in front of you. Somehow that just doesn't look to me like it's going to go anywhere. I mean, their message may be great, but there's something more than the message, you know? I mean, it's...
This lives... It's like, you know, those horror movies, you know, The Thing.
The Blob.
Or it. Yeah, or The Blob. Or The Crawling Eye. You know, famous grade B horror movies. It's more like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, codifying things and, you know... trying to be too enthusiastic about convincing someone of something, it gets tiresome.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have to say, this included, but in general, I'm not as prone to get invested in whatever the outcome is like that. So if something comes through, that's great, you know, but I'm not necessarily expecting, you know.
You are nobody's devotee.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, So, back to the question at hand. Does someone have a question at hand?
Well, I read that UG Krishnamurti thing. I don't know if you looked at it. That thing I sent.
I did look at some of it. It was more lengthy than I could stand.
Yeah,
but
exactly. And
I picked out some gems.
What did you pick out?
Oh, I don't know. Just, you know, some kind of fun things about the interviewer, you know, gradually melting as, you know, Yuji would instruct him in gazing at reality through a different lens.
I mean, it seemed very similar to the stuff we talk about, although confusing at times for sure. Like,
yeah,
you know, intuitively picking it up, but then also feeling confused, I guess. He seems to be saying at some point that, you know, that translating gets in the way of being melding with, you know, whatever this is, or I don't know how I would describe it. But it's just weird, the idea of language, like thought and language, and just thinking about those things, I get confused. Like, I kind of know what he's saying, but I also feel confused.
Yeah. I mean, I think he was confused. And, I mean, it takes a very, let's say, deft hand. And, what would you call it? A kind of TCP/IP connection for us to use language as a rider to convey or explore how consciousness is playing at the present moment. If we make it too academic or too heavy-handed, then that engages, it triggers our tendency to create representation and then identify with that representation.
Like, does there have to be like a frame of reference? Like, if you're born a deaf mute and people don't talk to you, it seems like your experience would be more unencumbered. But I mean, I don't know if that's true. It's almost like you have to go from having that unencumbered childlike experience to having it and then not having it again.
Well, sure, it can look like that sine wave. I mean, was Helen Keller enlightened?
I don't know, but she seemed pretty fearless in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not an expert about her or anything, but...
No, right.
She seemed pretty happy to be able to have language.
I would imagine she was, you know, ecstatic. I mean, and she's kind of a good point in a way. I mean, there, you know, there she was, as normal as anyone, except for the, you know, lamentable impairments of her five senses, or whatever senses were not working. But she still had all of the vitality of her own mind and the subtle urgency of, you know, a frontal brain, or call it consciousness, that loves to imbue itself with meaning and representation. You know, we're jokesters. We're all, you know, thinking, you could say, is just a giant practical joke. And so there she was, imbued with all of that profound activity and, you know, no way to convey her inner resources to another person, right? And everything that was going on with her and whatever language she might have subtly created, she understood.
But in a way, Don't we all feel like that?
Yes, absolutely. There's no question we do.
She's just an exaggerated virgin. And yet, how many of us would give up hearing and or sight in order to be enlightened? It's like, no way.
You might. Yeah. Good point.
Soon enough.
Yeah, right. It'll, yeah. Right. I'll give up continence to be enlightened.
Oh, God, no.
That guru, she shits herself.
Let's not play that game. That would be terrible. I hate that game.
That would be devoted followers.
Yeah.
I don't want to live at that ashram.
Good taste of it, you know, and then no. Like, I really like that better. Like, I know Shinzen would say, you would rather spend one day in an awake state than your whole life not in an awakened state.
Okay, I'm sorry, say that again? Who said that?
Oh, this guy I followed, Shinzen Young.
He said he'd rather spend one day awake.
Something like, if you could have one day awake, that would be preferable than a lifetime of non-awakened.
Well, that might be true.
That's a tall order. Yeah, so, you know, comparison is fun, but somewhat frivolous.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I kind of got from that UG Krishnamurti article.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, once you kind of commit, then your cellular structure changed. But I mean,
could be.
Yeah.
What now we'd have to. We'd have to talk to our friends at the, Gnostic Institute or whatever it is to see if they've done any biologic studies on known enlighteners.
I'm sure the TM people have stuff on that.
Yeah, all we have to do is give a call to Iowa, just about any place in Iowa, and they'll tell us all about it.
It seems that the tendency is to take enlightenment and turn it into an object.
Well, look what you're doing with the present miracle in front of your very nose.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable. I mean, let's call it the urgency and rapidity with which we organize the raw material of experiencing, right, into an object-subject revelation is fierce. It's not going to be broken.
Not by the mind that...
Not at all. Not at all. Therefore, seeing that, you could say you might enter into a hyper-intelligence, a meta-intelligence. Which is absolutely appreciative of meaning making and also transcendent of the consequence of it. And that's a little strange because it's what do they say? Both and, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
admitting you can't change it, but then that's fine too.
Yes, you see that this creates and assumes meaning and identity as quickly and efficaciously as it does not bind you. But you have to see it. You have to lean into it. And as you mentioned earlier, guidance along the way can be very useful.
But you know, one thing it occurs to me is that I'm finding individual expressions, and let's take, you know, these people that speak of non-duality. Their individual expressions are either sort of averaged out or they're into their own trip. Whatever the case, it doesn't necessarily relate to the world that I see, it only in a certain kind of way. So there's a lot of detail to it, to me, it's like anybody else projecting their universe, you know, everybody has their own universe. There might be a universal self, if you want to think of it that way, but still as an embodiment, everybody's projecting what they are, what they know, you know, that sort of thing. And it's different.
Yeah, the soft-spoken, boring gal from Vermont, whose name escapes me, presents a lot differently than Paul Hederman.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And neither one has a claim necessarily. You know, they're not offering a particular path. It's just like they're speaking from their reality. So it seems to me you just have to see that as their reality and then do what works for you.
I mean, who gives a shit about their reality? You know, you're interested in your reality.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're so used to borrowing or taking, you know, being the student, you know, and taking the words of the master or what have you. But, you know, it's helpful. But sometimes, you know, you just have to think in your own way without any of that.
You must. You can't think or encounter this through the metaphors of someone else.
Yeah.
And you can't even think or encounter this through your own metaphors. I mean, that's how strange it is that, you know, even you, who's all you've got, is going to fail at this.
Yeah. The one constant.
Yeah. So, you know, when we refer to a meta observation, right? Let's say you can feel, not fragmentarily, but if I may invite you to feel in its entirety the hysteria of human consciousness. Without, I'm not talking value judgment. Right? You can just like, whoa. Now you can't do that if you particularize. You can only do it through, let's say, an absolute transcendent yes. Yes, it's like, oh my goodness, look what this is capable of.
Yeah.
Look at the depth and the fractality of the dreaming, of the expression of subjects and objects, the passage of time, the curious nature of a million textures occurring all at once, going by or evaporating so quickly that anything I might have to say about them is 10,000 years too late. So we have this miraculous capacity for a transcendent yes, which is, feel it as an embrace, right, of the entirety of consciousness. Wow. And in seeing it this way, one is not frozen to any particular set or symptoms of belief or identity. And that simple gesture places you in a non-position. You can't quite say as the witnesser, but you might suggest as the appreciator of the entirety of manifest expression. And that which can appreciate the entirety of manifest expression The unadulterated, disembodied yes is other than the expression. And I don't mean to create a unnecessary bifurcation or a dichotomy. It's more that all of the symptoms are appearing as or in something that is not a thing and not afflicted or afflictable by the symptoms. This is the, you know, the transcendent yes.
Appearing in, but not resonant therein.
Well, it's curious because from one hand we can say there's no bridge between the transcendent intelligence, which is unafflicted, and its permutation. No bridge. Mm-hmm. And yet you can say the opposite, that emptiness is form, and form is emptiness. And so this remarkable intelligence, which is capable of feeling itself as an absolutely unadulterated yes, is also not afflicted or afflictable by all the symptoms that appear in it as it. Its own miraculous capacity for subjectification and objectification. And you can catch a glimpse, excuse me, of it. Or you can actually rest as it. And though invulnerability may be something attractive, you know, to a suffering human, this transcendent yes doesn't really have a vested interest in invulnerability.
Well, there are no vested interests, period, right?
That's right. That's right. This curious anthropomorphization is radiant, dissolving, evaporating, constant but never began. It's not measurable, and language is a unit of measure. Right? Mind is a unit of measure, but your actual experience is not measurable.
You know, I'm not sure how to put this, but it's pretty basic. There's a lot of times you will say things that are denying what most people or what people I would expect would say. Well, that's crazy. You know, how can you deny the existence of this or that? When I hear other non-dual talk, there seems to be a tendency. It's almost like you feel there are two camps. It's almost like two paths. You know, there's this spirit. And then there's this everything else, you know, that we feel and see and hear and all that jazz and think and all the stuff that goes on. And so it seems as though the denial is of all this other stuff, including what we think of ourselves and our self-image and all that jazz. But somehow that seems too simple.
Well, it's not an outright denial. It's more, what would you say, a revelation of the unbinding.
Yeah.
That nothing that's appearing, you know, in phenomenality, gross or subtle, subject or object, is binding. So there's no real good, nothing really good can come of, you know, a denial or comparison or accusing someone of an XYZ understanding and someone else of a ZYX understanding. Because your present experience, if we can call it that, is always and forever transcendent of comparison. It's not appearing in a volume, and it doesn't occur by virtue of measure or comparison.
Do you think that the reluctance to put a name to it, like spirit, is for good reason?
Well, it kind of depends on the crowd. You know,
yeah.
If you're at a pagan conference and that's the word they need to hear, and if you want to get your honorarium, you'd better say spirit.
All right.
Right? And you, but see, again, you can appreciate that this loves to pretend to land. Identity, what we call identity, is merely a short phrase for this loves to pretend to land.
Yeah. It seems to me that just the idea of naming anything, put some substance into it, and there you go again.
Add water and stir.
Right.
Yeah. That's right. Krishnamurti, you know, told this joke, which of course I'll botch, when someone runs up to God and says, oh, there's a new religion starting down there. It's sweeping the nation. You know, everyone's changing faith. You know, aren't you worried about it? And no, I'm sorry. It wasn't God. Someone runs to the Beelzebub and says, there's a new wave of faith.
Easy to miss that.
Know, it's the same. There's a new wave of faith going on down there. It's sweeping, you know, the nation and the countryside. Everyone is catharting, you know, in this new thing. Aren't you concerned? And the devil says, no, I'll just help them organize it.
Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, so, you know, that's not just apropos of religious or spiritual ideation. That's apropos of consciousness itself.
Yeah.
This, what does this do? Well, it only does one thing. Really? What would that be? Oh, simple. It self-obscures. What else does it do? You see, there's absolutely no deliverable that can be accommodated or accomplished by your consciousness, because this isn't anything. Meaning it can only do, if it's doing anything, it can only do one thing. And that's, it self-obscures. That's all it can do. What we want from it, from a, let's call it cathartic, you know, appetite or expectation, it's not actually capable of. Because no matter how many catharses you may have, purchased or for free, they're not it. And again, this sense of a transcendent yes to however big your embrace can possibly be for all of, right, subjectified and objectified expression. You just say yes to the entirety of it. You leave nothing, no stone unturned. Oh my God, yes, yes, yes. And with that intelligence, you're able to perceive that this only does one thing, and that's it self-obscures. then you're released from the being antagonized inwardly of having to try to accomplish something. You see? Oh, there's nothing to accomplish here. There's no enlightenment that I could possibly sign on to or that might even occur. I'm not even interested in, you know, the golden calf enlightenment anymore. Because what would be the point? All this does is self-obscure. That seeing is, you know, for fun, I would say, more bankable. Because it's transcendently so, and it's not dependent, right? Your disembodied yes, your transcendent yes, does not enter into a dependency relationship. That's how free you actually are. You're not capable of entering into a dependency relationship with that which obscures. You're like, oh, this obscures. I think I'll have some whitefish and a cup of tea. Now you don't have to become, a demonstratively cathartic yogi going into samadhis, you know, at the sight of a snowstorm. You can just be, you know, you, the heretical marionetteer. Pokey and Gumby on an adventure like Brokeback Mountain. Gumby and Pokey have gone up to the high ridge. Puppet incest. I don't know what you do if two claymation figures actually get stuck together in a carnal position. I mean, at least dogs, you can throw water on them, you know?
Yeah, two in Siamese twins. Got to cut them apart.
And, you know, we can appreciate the power of reproductive mitotic carnality in all waves of, you know, biologic and cosmic expression. It's pretty awesome, right? Binary star systems and black holes, event horizons, right? Supernova. I mean, talk about getting a Woody. And we see this carnality at every single level of macro and microscopic observation. It's part of the big yes. It's a big day, you could say, when rather than going in search of, perpetually in search of, we just sit down, you know, on our own stone. There's nothing other than us, nothing above, nothing below, nothing other than us, sitting on our own stone, our own tucket.
or in Nan's case, Nantucket.
Nantucket. It's not that difficult, it seems, to kind of bypass the insatiable heresy of human identification, which is so rife with disappointment and comparison and anger and projection. It's just not possible to get a glimpse of the effulgent yes navigating through the thick jungle of one's human disappointment. So we're not dismissing suffering, belittling our suffering or anybody else's. Suffering's cool. No crime, suffering. No reason to celebrate or deny. But if we're interested in a subtle view, then we have to approach that from an atmosphere of sobriety.
It seems like as soon as we start talking about suffering, it just naturally goes to the relief of suffering, and it's just going down a path.
That's a bad cyclone to be in,
yeah.
Right? Identification with suffering and the animus that we throw at the relief or release from suffering. It's a dead end. You know, the Buddha could have said, dead end. But instead, you know, he emphasized, or at least, you know, those that codified his teachings years later, right, emphasized teaching suffering and the end of suffering. Yeah. And he may have meant something, you know, more subtle and cogent than how we have embraced it in the West.
Or he may have just wanted something to stick, and he didn't feel that something more subtle would work.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be nice if we could get our hands on him and say, what were you thinking?
We could have a seance.
We could. We should have a seance.
That would be fun.
Uh-huh. Bring back the Buddha.
Yeah.
Gads. Everything in the room will come alive and start floating off the ground. Like Night at the Museum.
I'm afraid there would be too many posers coming through.
Yeah. Yeah, we'd have to wade through like decades of posers. A bunch of dead spirits.
Right.
Impersonating the Buddha. Really. Nah, not you. Get out of here. Get out of here. Hit the road. Dwal Cool and Kutumi. Get out of here. Hit the road.
Do you consider them completely nuts?
Well, who knows? I mean, everything, you know, everything is a curious metaphor, because nothing is true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no ultimacy to any teaching. There's no ultimacy to the primacy of being. Its autonomy is absolute. It functions with complete impunity. That's the discovery, right? That what you are behind the scenes of the myth of subject and object is impunity itself. Immeasurable and not interested in measuring. And that, call it curious inhabitation, has to be felt, right? You have to feel this. And thank goodness you're in luck, because that's what you've got. The very feeling tone that you might call your inherent animation, right? Your inherent consciousness, your inherent curiosity, your inherent humor. That's all felt. Right? It's not a material accoutrement of you. It is you. And it's felt. And it's a kind of a scary but exciting leap to feel this as yourself and pierce the constructive human veil that this is the consequence of your birth. Right? That the profundity of your autonomy is not the consequence of birth. Yikes. Yowza. Woo. Yeah. That's a fun consideration. We become acquainted somehow with the texture of this transcendent yes. And so we relax from the seduction of, call it local affliction, temporal affliction, spatial affliction, being the possessor of consciousness as affliction. I mean, you're so seriously funny, you don't even need to tell a joke. That's how good you are. Transcendently humorous, you don't even have to tell a joke. You can just laugh out loud at yourself, not as the consequence of anything. Because you're funny. This is funny. It has kind of a weird tickle to it, right? It's like, oh, leave me alone. Oh, not that. Oh, please stop. Oh, no, please stop. Not really, that's what you got. You're being tickled silly from moment to moment. Why not just laugh at the whole thing? You can see how you can feel yourself, you can enjoy yourself spaciously, but not as the consequence of an idea. Not because you're hell-bent on getting anywhere. Not because you're trying to explain something or prove anything to anyone, including yourself. You're a transcendent giggle. Autonomously so. You could say unearned and undeserving, but who cares? It's still the case. You are unearned and undeserving. But you are still a transcendent giggle. God has poured everything she's got into you. That even includes the stuff on the floor that they make the hot dogs from. You're kind of like spam enlightened. Because you're made from the stuff on the floor of the meat house.
Scrapple.
You are Scrapple. You're Scrapple lightened. Beat that, Rupert Shiloh. Spira. Spira. Fuck you, Rupert. We are Scrapple lightened. Eat shit, Bart. We're made out of fucking scrapple. That's the sixth noble truth. The fifth one after you've failed at the eightfold path is gossip at will. And the sixth one is, ooh, I forgot to tell you, you're a scrapple. But you don't come to those teachings until you failed at the eightfold path.
Scrapple and stardust.
That's right. Scrapple and stardust. You're good on toast. Yum. I mean, it's hard to make a religion out of it, that ye are scrapple.
That works. As soon as you say ye and thee and
yeah.
That helps.
Yeah. I mean, all we need is one property with a pitched roof, and we'll call it, you know, the Church of Scrapple. Everyone is welcome. No one will come.
Well, the pinball wizard got a lot of hits. I mean,
yeah.
Who knows who will come?
That's right. Yeah, when it's not about anything. Experience is not about anything. It's not the consequence of anything. You know, the curious myth and texture of being a suffering human doesn't matter enough to even be healed. Which is a little weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's curiously possible, though strange, to, let's say, mature in an authentic manner, without having to wade through the particularization of human identity. Yeah. That's a little odd, you know, that transcendent association can actually assist you, nourish you, make you buoyant in intelligence without having to resolve the curious signature of your human frailties.
Well, there's no resolution anyway, so the sooner you can discover that, I guess, the better.
Yes, and that is a maturing process, not necessarily a psychiatric or emotional maturing process, but it's still a maturing process. Right? I mean, a certain amount of, you could say, transcendent mist, transcendent humidity has to be in the air for you to be in relationship with your being without having to wade through the human filtration system. That is a certain kind of maturing. It has its empathy. It has its humor. It has its, you know, its depth and its insightful gifts. And if psychiatric shit or emotional shit is begging for attention, then why be an idiot? Give it some attention.
Yeah.
You know. We're not trying to wiggle free of anything. including suffering, including vulnerability, imagined or otherwise. This is an arrival, right? Not a amelioration. Yeah. Right? A lot of seeking is fueled by amelioration. But intelligence, spam house, scrapple house, that's an arriving. I think your friend Ron Veer tried to join us the other evening. I saw him lingering in the chat room, and he scurried away, kind of like a little rabbit in the woods.
I was wondering, because I saw that you had listed him. I'm like, wow, so this is how I have to meet Ron Veer now. You know? So I haven't seen him in a while.
Yeah. Well, I figured if he was bold enough to attempt to join us on Tuesday, that he might be cajoled to try to try again.
I was kind of hoping he was, yeah, that he would have been.
Yeah.
Was he on for a few minutes and then left?
Yeah, he was. I could see he had joined the chat, and he actually typed something into the window, and by the time I responded and invited him to stay, he had already disconnected.
Well, I wonder what happened.
He probably had been browsing through your Facebook page while he was dialing in and came across something and decided it wasn't such a good idea.
Yeah. Who knows? You know,
for an old IT guy, and he's been retired for a while from that, I'm kind of surprised sometimes at how little he seems to grasp the new things that are going on. You know, he's kind of awkward with them.
Oh, you mean technology?
Oh, maybe he didn't get Fuse. Okay.
Yeah, maybe he, I have no idea.
Who knows? It was nice to see him pop in.
Yeah.
He probably saw himself on camera.
Yeah. We hope, of course, to see Terry again soon, not just because of the carrot cake.
Yeah. I'll give her a little nudge. It has been.
Well, we're going to end up like the Shakers, this little intimate and insular ministry we've got going on here is just going to die off.
Let's all get all together.
Or this is right before the point where
we'll be like monkeys on the rocket ship.
Yeah. Yeah. I can feel that DNA.
You know, it is a combination of things. It's the I don't know what you would call it, the raw candor, I think, that is off-putting to people. They're used to life in the world where they have certain, sounds too negative to say, but I'll call it a pretense, what have you. And, I think it's a shift change, you know, for people to be able to handle it. You know, it seems, it's too raw or something.
Yeah.
Well, some of the basic message is you're fucked.
Yeah.
You can't really do anything to get to where you may think you need to be. There isn't any. You're just living it and just give it up, man.
Yes, the collapse of corporeal identity is not all that forgiving, really.
Yeah, the message is you're so completely unimportant, whereas that's not why people get into this. It's usually the opposite they want to figure out.
Well, sure. I'm looking for a new age babe, or a new age babe is looking for me, or, you know, it's a hookup game, right?
A lot of it.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, you know, why not?
Well, that sex thing you talked about.
It is. Where else are you going to meet someone as crazy as you, with which you can have a hellacious relationship, you know, but at a meditation retreat?
I mentioned being unimportant, and it's really pretty funny. I can groove on, yeah, I'm really, you know, this isn't that important in this, and all it takes is like one good insult or something at work that threatens
my image.
Like, you want to talk about ruining my day? Just take away a little piece of who I'm trying to be.
Yeah, we are all sitting ducks.
Mm-hmm. And the level of pain in that, actually, like, it's like it thrusts me into, why the hell am I holding on to this so tight? Why does it, it's like, don't hold on to it so tight. That's where the suffering comes from.
Sure.
The more I hold on to who I think I want to be, should be, need to hold on to, the more I suffer.
Yes. Yeah, you could say there's a mathematical relationship between the depth or despair of clinging, you know, and the suffering that accompanies our psychic disappointment, or our you know, identity vulnerability.
It's like that sense of self is the cosmic booger I'm trying to flick.
Yeah.
like it just, get it off me.
Yeah. I think it's that simple. Yeah, you are a cosmic booger, and you can't wait to flick yourself off your own finger.
And you need to get off it.
Yeah. I mean, that's how this self obscures, or you could say that's another, you know, great insight into that this self obscures. It will identify with itself with remarkable speed and, you know, teeth dug in. It becomes vulnerable to insult. And that's, you know, part of the big yes is to say, "Oof, wow, check this out, man." This self obscures and creates a nonsensical identity and loyalty to that identity, which is actually non-existent.
You'd think,
why would we get so easily insulted when the root of our association is non-existent? I don't know. Maybe it's just because of the degree to which this invests in itself as a disparate apparatus. And so the slightest insult, you know, people closing the elevator doors before you get a chance to get on. You know, it could be anything.
We feel abandoned
and insulted or insecure, you know, not part of the tribe.
It seems like that's a total earmark of when you're more identified with self. You're actually, the level of vulnerability is the level at which you're fully identified with self.
Yes, I think that's a fair, you know, fair comparison or measure to make.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not absolutely true. It's just apparitionally so. Right? It's only apparitionally so. Because even the story told about times that I was vulnerable and or insulted or insultable is just imagined, right, in the present.
Yeah.
So everything that's wounded us, or that way we may be resisting, is only apparitionally a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as we let's say, come to appreciate or giggle at that fact, then you could say that's a sign or a symptom that your meta-intelligence is in play, that you are capable of observing the tenuous nature of subjectification and objectification appearing as your experience. So you're flicking off your booger.
I've had a hobby for quite some time of, you know, writing it all down. Every little reaction to those, quote, seeming insults, like just letting my mind run amok with it.
Yes.
Write it down. And that's the, you know, it's the Byron Katie stuff. But
yeah,
it's fascinating to watch when you give it all the leeway it wants, how sideways it'll get with something seemingly really small.
The entire universe is made from the smallest of dots. Mm-hmm. And so is the apparitional mushroom cloud that appears in our own present experience is made from nothing. Nothing at all.
Huh. I mean, I've said this before, I think, in this forum, is I've been told that this whole universe is held together by resistance to what is, or by those kind of judgments. If we didn't have some push against, there wouldn't be anything here.
Well, there is nothing.
Theoretically.
I mean, right now, there is nothing.
You said that earlier, like if you totally just were here, like no story around it, no anything about it, we wouldn't exist, right? Did you say something like that earlier in the talk?
Well, what you call existence, what any of us might call existence, is what exactly? Besides being untrue, what else is it?
Experience.
There's the direct experiential, and then there's this monster bubble coming out of my head with all this stuff. It seems like existence consists of almost two things: sensorium, and then the big bubble of everything that my mind is creating. What's going to happen tomorrow? What am I saying? How I look on the screen? You know, the whole thing.
And in the midst of this keen observation, is it possible to see that the sensorium is not made of anything? And the mind proliferation that may accompany the sensorium is likewise not made of anything.
I get how the mind shit is not made of anything. It's hard to get how the sensorium and like this table is not made of anything.
Well, you frame it only through memory. Through memory, you end up with the confidence that it is something.
So if I didn't think that this table was a table or this cat, my lap is a cat, if there wasn't that recognition through what I claim as past experience, it wouldn't be anything? Is that what you mean? Like, meet it fresh?
Well, make no claim and give your attention to whatever is present. What is it? Make no claim, but simply feel presence without destination. Is it anything?
Pretty quiet.
Yes.
Pretty quiet and pretty full.
Yes, curiously quiet, curiously full. Make no claim, and then start shouting about whether it's existent or not.
Hey, Nan, I'll have to check back with you later and see how you make out with that exercise, but I'm gonna leave. I'll see you.
Bye, Jamie.
All right, yep. Then.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
I think I...
He's trying to leave, but he can't.
He's stuck in cyberspace. We're not letting him go.
He's got toothpicks in his eyelids. This is a curious observation. We only crow about existence through the heretical reference of memory.
Yeah.
If you actually melt into what's present without claim, then there's no point of referring to it as existent or non-existent. Both of those are frivolous heresy. Existent to whom? Non-existent to whom? Or to what? That this is so, whatever it may or may not be, is sufficiently irrefutable that existence and non-existence really have no bearing, no merit. And you possess or are made of the uncanny intelligence that can feel itself without claim.
And that seems like it would be a meta realization.
Here you are. You've arrived. This is the meta realization. Not something in your future. Not something in your past. You are made of meta realization. Just now, just this. You are meta-realization. But this is so good at self-obscuring that you or I or anyone so easily mistakes this as being something else. And this mistaking this meta-realization to be something else is when all the claiming begins. And all of the claiming is just a bunch of horseshit. You're nothing but radiant revelation without a subject or an object. And you already know that you're that. Now it's just a matter of being willing to depart from all of the claiming, which appears to define my existence, you know, as a corporeally enshrined life. And as the claiming relaxes of its own accord, well, then you're not so easily duped into the confidence that you are a corporeally enshrined life. You more easily feel yourself as the unencumbered radiant, transcendent of existence and non-existence.